Okay, well, welcome back to part three of Ethics 2019, and we are going to be starting this segment of the program. If I can find my materials here again, we're going to be starting with Rule 6.1, and so in the remaining half hour, we're going to kind of finish up Rules 6, 7, and 8. And then for the fourth hour of the program, we'll go into the conflict of interest rules in a little bit more detail. And Rule 6 covers the rules for attorneys governing pro bono, because pro bono is something we're supposed to do. We're supposed to help those who are disadvantaged with their legal needs. And specifically, what our pro bono obligation is under Rule 6.1 is that we shall aspire to render at least 50 hours per year of pro bono service. So in other words, what you shall aspire to do. It doesn't say you actually have to do it. So, you know, December rolls around and you only have 49 hours. Well, that's okay, because you began the year thinking to yourself, yes, I'm going to do about 50 hours of pro bono service this year. Because, like I say, it's not a hard and fast requirement, but, well, it is a hard and fast requirement that you shall aspire to do it. So for those of you who are taking this program in late December, well, your New Year's resolution should be that you're going to do 50 hours of pro bono next year. And as long as you aspire to do that, well, nobody's keeping track of the actual hours. But that's an aspirational goal. And for most of us, that's pretty easy because we're doing pro bono hours all the time. But it is important, though, to keep in mind exactly what the definition of pro bono service is, because there are a lot of public service activities that are good things for us to be doing, but they don't specifically satisfy that 50-hour obligation, though, because what that pro bono requirement is that most of those 50 hours shall be devoted to helping the legal needs of persons of limited means. So that's the specific obligation. Doing whatever legal work you normally do, or whatever legal work you're competent to doing, but doing it at no charge for persons of limited means. And like I say, that's pretty easy to satisfy, because a lot of attorneys, it's seemingly we're doing that all the time, because a lot of times you help out people, there's really no expectation that they're going to be able to pay you for anything, but that's what you're supposed to be doing. Now, there are other activities that you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be, fighting to protect civil rights and trying to save the environment and all kinds of other things, and those are laudable things. In fact, you have kind of an obligation to do those things as well, but those don't count toward your 50 hours, because your 50 hours is pretty specific, is handling the day-to-day legal needs of persons of limited means, or performing services for organizations that are out there to assist people of limited means. So that's kind of a specific obligation, is to help persons of limited means with their legal needs, and you should aspire to do at least 50 hours of that per year. Now, in addition to that, without quantifying that, the rule goes into talking about the other kinds of things that we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be doing things for no fee or a really reduced fee to protect civil rights, civil liberties, or public rights. And we should also provide services to charitable, religious, and civic organizations in furtherance of those organizations' purposes. But like I said, there is no that's not quantified, but it's just kind of reminding us, yes, you should do these other public service-oriented activities as well. But like I say, your main pro bono obligation with that quantified amount is the aspiring to do the 50 hours of legal services for those of limited means. So that's good. We have that out of the way. We know what our pro bono obligation is. The reason why Rule 6 continues, though, why there's more about Rule 6, is because, well, there's some conflict of interest implications of some of these conflict of interest rules. Because if you're doing all these public service activities, well, maybe that might interfere with the rest of your practice of law. So in recognition of that, the remainder of Rule 6 talks about some exceptions or some relief that you might get from the normal conflict of interest rules. Oh, and I forgot to mention, though, Rule 6.2 is another specific obligation thing we're supposed to do. Is if the court wants to appoint you to represent somebody, you should not try to avoid that. So you should remain open to the fact that the court might appoint you to represent somebody. And you should not try to avoid it. So if you try to, if you sneak out of the courtroom because you think the judge is going to appoint you to represent this indigent person, then that's a violation of Rule 6.2. But those conflict of interest rules start with 6.3. First of all, Rule 6.3 talks about if you are serving as a officer or director of a legal services organization. So that's a laudable thing to do. That's something you should do. If the legal services corporation, the legal aid in your area, says, we would like you to serve on our board of directors. Can you do that? Well, you should say yes, because that's a public service oriented kind of thing. And it's, well, you're helping persons of limited means, so you should do that. But what if those clients in the legal aid society clients, what if those people have conflicts with your paying clients? So in other words, you're appointed to legal aid and you're representing these tenants, you're not representing them personally, but you're on the board of directors of the legal aid society that's representing all the tenants. Well, your private clients are the landlords in town, and your landlord clients are trying to evict your tenant clients. Well, if it was a private law firm, if you worked for two different law firms, one representing the tenants, one representing the landlords, that would be a huge conflict of interest, and that would not be allowed at all. You wouldn't be able to play any role. But in the context of a legal aid society kind of thing, and you're on the board of directors, we will overlook that conflict of interest, but you have to recuse yourself from those decisions. So just because the legal aid society is going up against your landlord clients, you don't have to resign from the organization like you would if it was a private law firm. But you have to recuse yourself. You can't take part in those decisions. You can't vote and say, yes, I think we should, sue all the landlords in town. No, you can't do that. Or you can't do it the other way either. You can't take any side on that. You have to recuse yourself. But you're not required to actually quit your job at one of the two. You can still work in that in that public service capacity. Rule 6.4 talks about law reform activities that affect your clients. So one of those public service activities that you're supposed to do is if the Bar Association comes to you and says, we want you to help reform the law. The state landlord-tenant code needs to be rewritten. So we want you to help rewrite it, and we'll present that to the legislature, and hopefully we'll get some new statutes enacted and reform these old, 100-year-old statutes that nobody understands or whatever. That's something you're supposed to do. That's a public service kind of activity that you're supposed to engage in. But, maybe your private clients like the law the way it is. They're not having any problems with these rules, and they would just soon not rock the boat. So can you do that? And the answer is yes. As long as you're permitted to serve as a director, officer, or member of an organization that's reforming the law, even though that your clients may be benefited or harmed by the decision that's made, you have to disclose that. When you're sitting on the Bar Association Committee and say, should we rewrite this part of the code, and say, no, I think we should leave that the way it is. You have to say, by the way, my clients will benefit if we do that. But you don't have to identify the client. But you do have to disclose that that you have a client interest to your fellow members of the Bar Association Committee. Nonprofit legal service programs. So, for example, you volunteer at the law school legal clinic. Or you're a member of the Bar Association, and the Bar Association is doing Law Day at the mall. So people can come in and talk to an attorney about their legal needs. Well, that's encouraged. That's an activity that you're supposed to do because it's a public service activity, and that's a good thing that you're doing those things. But there's a possibility that when you give legal advice to these people that you met at the mall or at the law school basement, well, it's possible those people will have be a conflict of interest with your private clients. And normally you're supposed to screen pretty carefully for conflicts of interest. You want to make sure that you never have a conflict of interest. But in those situations, it might just be unavoidable. So, so you represent in your day-to-day practice of law, you represent, all the landlords in town, or some of the landlords in town. And while you're down at the mall and somebody comes in and they're this tenant and their apartment is falling apart and the landlord is not giving them back their deposit and there are all kinds of, there's lead paint all over the place. So you tell these people, well, that's terrible, you should sue that landlord, sue them for every penny they got. Well, unbeknownst to you, that the landlord was one of your private clients. This excuses that violation, because in that situation, if you are not aware of the conflict of interest and you're giving kind of general legal advice, then you don't have to worry about that conflict of interest. Now, if you're aware that it's your client, if you're aware that there's a conflict of interest, then this rule does not apply, and the normal rule applies. But in that limited nonprofit kind of situation, Rule 6.5 kind of relaxes the conflict of interest rules just a little bit. So anyway, Rule 6 says do your pro bono, specifically aspire to do your pro bono. And what you should aspire to is that 50 hours per year. Like I say, if you're taking this program in December, make that your New Year's resolution that you will do 50 hours of pro bono next year. Rule 7 talks about communication with the public, specifically advertising kinds of communication. First of all, Rule 7.1 says that any communication that you make with the public can't be false or misleading. So even if it's not a paid advertisement, if you're being interviewed by the newspaper or television, you have to be truthful in your communications that you make with the public. So you can't even be misleading, because if you make if it's materially misleading, that's bad enough. So always be truthful anytime you talk to the media or to the public. Rule 7.2 specifically talks about advertising and some other related issues. The first thing it talks about is that. We talked about this already when we talked about Rule 1.5 about fee splitting. But here is where the rule is. It says Rule 7.2 says referral fees are not allowed. Referral fees are not permitted in Minnesota. Period. It's not allowed. You cannot accept money from another attorney to send cases to that attorney. You cannot pay anybody to send cases to you. That's just not allowed ever. As we talked about when we talked about Rule 1.5, there's something similar that is allowed, and that is you can share the fee with somebody where you're sharing the work or sharing the responsibility But whatever you do, don't call it a referral fee, because I think Rule 7.2 is very clear, saying it's referral fees are not allowed. Even though, well, yeah, there was a referral that took place, but I was getting paid for the services I provided or for the responsibility they might maintain. But you can't get paid for the referral. And I think, like I say, Rule 7.2 is pretty clear. But there are exceptions to that. For example, we talked about sale of a business. Yeah, you can sell your law office business, even though that's kind of like a referral fee. But you have to make sure that all those rules apply. And the other big exception is, well, you can't pay people to refer cases to you. But that's kind of like what advertising is. Because advertising, you're paying somebody, like the newspaper or the TV station or the website, to say, hey, send people my way. So it's kind of a referral fee. But if it's a bona fide advertisement and you're paying the normal reasonable cost of an advertisement, that does not count as a referral fee. So that's an exception to a referral fee, that if it's a legitimate advertisement. Rule 7.2 says that, yes, you can advertise. Now, that's historically, it's getting to be pretty ancient history in most states, but historically, lawyers did not advertise. Advertising was a dirty word back in the day for attorneys. And that's changed mostly quite a while ago. But, for example, Iowa, until about 5 years ago, they maintained some pretty strict advertising rules that were largely unenforceable because it was commercial speech, and under the First Amendment, the rules that were in place probably were not very enforceable. But now, several years ago, Iowa changed those rules. And if you're taking this program for Iowa credit, the rules in Iowa are pretty much in line with what they are in just about every other state. They say, yes, lawyers can advertise. There are two kind of substantive restrictions on your advertising. One is it has to be truthful. Because it makes clear that even if it's an advertisement, Rule 7.1 still applies, and any statements that you make in public or you pay somebody in an ad to say that has to be truthful. So you can't say, I'm the smartest lawyer in the state, unless you really are the smartest lawyer in the state. So it has to be truthful. But really the only other substantive restriction on advertising is that the advertisement has to include the name of at least one attorney or law firm that is responsible for the content of the advertisement. Normally that's not a problem. If you put a TV ad, say, I'm attorney so-and-so, and, I'm a good attorney, come to me. Obviously you're identifying who you are. Where that would come into play, though, is, if you, for example, billboard advertising or something. You want to put up a billboard at the dangerous intersection, that just says, injured, call 1-800-INJURY, and we will help you. If you put up a billboard like that, you have to say, this billboard sponsored by, so-and-so attorney at law or the so-and-so law firm. You have to have the name of the firm there. But other than that, that's really the only substantive restriction on what is in your ads. Now, one kind of specific category of advertising is direct contact with prospective clients, Rule 7.3. And before we get to that, I will give you the next code number for those of you taking the podcast. If you're taking it live today, don't worry about this. But if you're taking the podcast, the next code number is F64. F as in Fox 64. F64 is the next code word for this portion of the program, F64. What Rule 7.3 has to say is kind of a specialized category of advertising is, you go down to the courthouse and get the name of everybody who got arrested over the weekend, or the names of all the people who are getting sued in small claims court, or whatever. So you, you get this list of names from public records or wherever, or you know, you scour the you know, official notices in you know, legal newspapers. In fact, I got one. I filed a probate case recently, and I get this email from some kind of, you know, kind of a little bit tagged. It wasn't an attorney, but you know, they probably got it out of Finance and Commerce because I had published a notice there, or maybe they just got a list of the court filings. But you know, this was a new probate case that was filed, so I got this email from this person saying, you know, oh, we buy houses. Do you have a house for sale from the estate? You know, so, you know, like that person wasn't an attorney, but if it was an attorney, you know, contacting somebody saying that, oh, I understand, you know, you filed this and, you know, we do real estate services. Well, then this rule applies. Well, first of all, that's okay with written contact. You can send letters to those people. So you send letters to saying, hey, I understand you got arrested over the weekend. You know, you had that little problem with that DWI. Well, you're in luck because I'm a DWI attorney. I'll help you out. Here's how to contact me. Or, yeah, we understand you're, you know, the Visa card people are suing you in small claims court. Well, you're in luck. I do bankruptcy. So give me a call. We'll take care of that for you. Are you allowed to send letters like that? And the answer is yes. In fact, interestingly, even in Iowa that had very, very restrictive rules on advertising, that was pretty much always permitted. And it's still permitted there and in most states, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin. It is permitted to do it in writing. It can't be direct contact. It can't be telephone contact. It can't be, you know, live chat contact. Or something, but you can send emails to people or send letters to people saying, yes, I can help you out with this problem that you have pending right now. It's permitted, you have to, unless they told you not to, or they told you if you're harassing them or something. There are some pretty specific rules. And those specific rules vary a little bit from state to state. So you want to look at your own state's rule before you send out letters like that. For example, let's see, I think on the outside envelope and on the letter, you have to have the words advertising material. And it's a specific size font that you have to use and specific words. In fact, I think the words changed recently. They used to say advertisement only. So look at your own state's rules, because I'm not sure if the Minnesota and Wisconsin rules are exactly the same. There are some magic words you have to use. You have to use the words advertising material or whatever specifically the rule says, and there's a certain font that you have to have, and it has to be on the letter. You know, because people freak out when they get letters from attorneys. You put on the envelope advertising material. Well, they don't freak out quite so much. So that's why they have that rule. Now, incidentally, I mentioned this. I don't know many attorneys who actually do this. Although, you know, occasionally, you know, like I said in that email that I got after filing a probate, you see there are people doing that. Both attorneys and non-attorneys. One attorney who tried it, you know, they went down to the courthouse and got the names of everybody who got arrested over the weekend and sent them out letters. He said it doesn't really pay off. They spend a lot of time on the phone. So when people get this letter, they get a lot of phone calls asking for free legal advice, but they didn't actually get very many clients out of it. So I don't know if it's worth it, but if you do think it's worth it, like I say, you have to follow the rules and make sure that you have that magic wording, advertising material, on the letter and on the envelope, and don't do it in person. The other thing covered by this rule is, yes, you can be part of a prepaid group legal service plan as long as you comply with those rules. Now, some states, when you send out those letters that are unsolicited, you know, saying, you know, you got arrested over the weekend. In Wisconsin, for example, you have to send a copy of that advertisement to a particular office of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And some states have that rule. Minnesota does not. Iowa proposed such a rule, but then when their final rules did not include that, I don't think. So if you are going to engage in that kind of marketing, you want to make sure that you carefully read your state's version of the rule. And it seems to me that Wisconsin rule, that makes more sense than anything, because if I was going to send out some kind of overreaching or inappropriate letter, well, if I knew I was sending a copy of it to the state Supreme Court, I would probably be a lot more careful in what I said. So that's probably the best approach. But not all states have that requirement, although quite a few of them do. Rule 7.4 says that, yes, you are allowed to say what you do for a living. And interestingly, until several years ago, that was not the case in Iowa. Iowa attorneys were not allowed to say what they did for a living unless they used very specific language that was approved by the rules. And that particular language didn't always work very well. But that's wide open now. And that's, I think, a really good thing. Even whatever you think of attorney advertising, well, you really ought to be able to tell people what you do for a living. Because what the former rule was in Iowa was that, yeah, you can say that you practice in a certain area of the law, but you had to use the terminology contained in the rule. And they had a long list of practice areas. And most of the practice areas were covered. You know, so if you were in personal injury, there was an appropriate category you could check, and you could use those words. Or if you did bankruptcy, you know, there was that was on the list. But one attorney I know who made comments to the Iowa Supreme Court when the rules were pending was it was kind of a big problem for her because she practiced in the area of military pensions, which is a very narrow, arcane area of the law that not many people know anything about. But that's what she did. She handled military pensions. And she was located near the state line to make things worse. So I forget if she was in Council Bluffs or in the Quad Cities. But she wasn't allowed to say what she did for a living because military pensions was not on the list. But her colleagues across the river in, I forget if it was Nebraska or Illinois, they were allowed to say, we do military pensions. But she wasn't allowed to say that because it wasn't on the list. So that obviously kind of hampered her practice. Because there were things on there, well, there was military law, for attorneys who do, court martials and stuff. That wasn't what she did. And there was just pension law. Well, she didn't do that because that, private civil pensions were very different from military pensions. So now she's allowed to say what she does for a living. So I think that's a good thing. You can do that. You've always been able to say that you're an admiralty attorney or proctor in admiralty, because that was always written in the words. Now you'd think there are not too many admiralty attorneys in Iowa, but I was at a CLE one time and this attorney I was talking to was proudly telling me that he handled an admiralty case in Iowa, one of the few maritime cases, because he was the attorney for, I don't know, the buyer or the seller of a ship or something, but the ship was sailing through Iowa on Interstate 80. And he went into the Admiralty Division of the Iowa District Court to seize this ship as it sailed through on the back of a trailer. He's always been able to say that he was a proctor in Admiralty in Iowa. So that's always been in there. Now, what you're not allowed to say, though, so be careful, is never say that, never use the word certified or the word specialist or any variation thereof. Because anytime you use those magic words, then a separate set of rules kicks in that you have to be very careful about. So you are allowed to say, I practice in the area of bankruptcy, or I limit my practice to bankruptcy cases, or you can say I do a lot of bankruptcy cases, or you can use just about anything you want, but you can't say that I specialize in bankruptcy. Because if you say that, then these special rules kick in, and because you are only allowed to use the word those words if the C word or the S word, the certified or specialist, you're only allowed to use those words if you are a certified specialist by a particular agency, and those rules vary a little bit from state to state. If you are a certified criminal law specialist by the Iowa Bar Association, or a certified trial lawyer by the American Trial Lawyers Association, or whatever. If you are one of those, well, you know what the rules are, and you're allowed to say that. What the rules are in Minnesota, I can say that. Well, I can't say it because I'm not. But if I were, I could say I'm a certified real property specialist by the Minnesota State Bar Association. In Minnesota, the rule is that I can say that as long as the Minnesota State Bar Association is on the list of approved certifying agencies by the Minnesota Board of Legal Specialists or whatever. So if they're on that list, then I can do that. But if if I say I'm a certified real property specialist by the National Property Lawyers Association, an organization that I just incorporated myself, that it's just a diploma mill, I can't do that because they're not on the list of agencies that can do that. So that's the rule in Minnesota. It has to be on the list. The rule in Iowa is, the rule in Iowa is that you have to include specific language saying the Supreme Court of Iowa does not recognize specialties, and all lawyers can practice in any. You have to use their boilerplate language. And like I said, different states will have different rules about what you have to do if those two words, certified or specialist, or any variation thereof, appear in your advertisement or in any kind of communication, and you have to comply with those state rules. To show the absurd extreme of that rule is some poor hapless New York attorney got himself into a little bit of trouble because what he did was he put on his LinkedIn profile, he put, "I specialize in tough cases." Well, the New York bar came to him and said, "Oh, excuse me, can I see your certification from the National Association of Tough Cases, showing that you were a certified specialist in the area of tough cases?" Well, of course he didn't have that because he was just kind of a whimsical thing that he said. But again, he used the S word. He said he specializes in tough cases, and you're not allowed to do that unless you comply with those rules. So, I guess you could say that in Iowa, you could say, "I specialize in tough cases. The Iowa Supreme Court does not recognize specialty." That would sound kind of silly. Or in Minnesota, you wouldn't be able to do it unless it was on that list of certifying agencies. So the takeaway of Rule 7.4 is don't use the word specialist or don't use the word certified unless you meet those special requirements. Try to think of some other word to include in your ad. So don't say you specialize in tough cases. You say, "I love tough cases," or whatever. That would be fine. Firm names. Can lawyers use a trade name? The answer is yes. It's pretty wide open. You can call yourself anything you want. So if you want, you're going to put up that billboard saying 1-800-INJURY, you can change the name of your law firm to, 1-800-INJURY LLP or whatever. And then you've complied with that requirement. If you can call your firm pretty much anything you want to, as long as it's not false or misleading. Or what you have to watch out for is you can't start a law firm in a name that implies a connection to a government agency or a nonprofit organization. So the safe way is never use the name of a political entity, like Minnesota or Iowa or Dane County or Des Moines or Minneapolis, because if you use something like that in your firm name, then you run the risk of somebody saying, well, that sounds like the name of a government agency. Because I'm located in Ramsey County, Minnesota, so I decided to call my law firm Ramsey County Lawyers. Well, then that's not appropriate, because there's a government agency called the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and I'm kind of implying a connection with that. So I should not use that. If you're going to use a geographic term, make sure it's not a political subdivision. So don't call yourself Iowa Bankruptcy Attorneys. Call yourself Hawkeye Bankruptcy Attorneys, or Great Lakes Law Firm or whatever. If you use something like that, or Twin Cities, if you use a term like that, then you're not running the risk. But again, be careful if you use a city or a state or a county name as part of your firm name, or possibly in Iowa, and this might apply in other states, even though they were a little bit more specific, it applies to your website URL. For example, if you some of these examples are actually in use, I think, and I'm just pulling them off the top of my head, but I've checked some of them out and they're actually in use. So not disparaging the particular attorneys using these, but for example, DesMoinesLawyers.com. That's a little bit problematic, because that's kind of implying that you're part of the, I wouldn't think this and you wouldn't think this, but an overzealous regulator might look at it and say, well, you're implying a connection with the Des Moines City Attorney's Office. So I would be careful using those. I would, I would not use stpaulattorney.com. I would use twincitiesattorney.com or, Gopher State Attorneys or whatever, because that way you don't have to worry about that. Also, some states have taken the position that the word clinic kind of implies that you're a nonprofit. And I don't really see that, because, the word clinic to me does not mean nonprofit, because most medical clinics make plenty of profit, so I don't really see that. But some courts have seen it. They say, well, if you call yourself the Twin Cities Legal Clinic, that sounds like you're a nonprofit clinic. So I would just avoid that word too. But you definitely want to avoid names of cities or counties or states as part of your firm name or the website URL. You want to watch out that. And also in Iowa attorneys taking this, if the, my website, for example, is richardclem.com. So I would be okay under the Iowa rule, because that's just a minor variation on my official firm name or my actual name. But if I put up a website called twincitiesattorneys.com, I would have to include my actual name and address, which is not stated in the Minnesota rule, but the Minnesota rule already says that all advertisements, including websites, I would think, have to include the name of one attorney. So, like I say, richardclem.com, I don't need any additional disclaimer, but if I use some other name, the website would have to prominently show my name and address of the attorney who's primarily responsible for it. So anyway, that's Rule 7.5, firm names. And then last but not least, Rule 7.6, I forget now which state did not adopt this, but I know Iowa has Rule 7.6. You shall not accept a government legal engagement or appointment by a judge if you made a political contribution for the purpose of being considered for that, which kind of sounds to me like bribery. So obviously, if you you know, the judge is running for re-election, so you you know, make a campaign contribution to the judge and say, "Hey, judge, the next time you need a you know, a special master appointed, especially in those lucrative cases, be sure to remember that I gave you a campaign contribution." Well, that would be a violation of this this rule. It'd probably be a violation. I'm sure there's a criminal law against that, so you'd probably go to jail if you did that. Like I say, some state, I forget which one it was, maybe it was Minnesota, did not adopt Rule 7.6. I don't know why, because, like I say, it's covered by the general campaign finance laws, I would think. Like I say, that you want to you don't want to do that anywhere, but especially in states that have that specific version of Rule 7.6. So anyway, that rules 1 through 7 that we've covered so far are kind of the substantive rules, and then rule 8 is kind of the miscellaneous and procedural rules. And before we get to rule 8, I guess I'll give you another one of those code numbers, and that will be G as in golf 79. G79. G79 is the second code number for this this segment of the program, G79. Rule 8 kind of covers miscellaneous. Rule 8.1 says that you have to be truthful in your dealings with the you know, state bar authorities in connection with your admission and disciplinary matters. And other people's bar applications. So if they you know, if they call you up and say, you know, so and so just graduated from law school and they applied to be a member of the bar, you know, we're making this request for information about them. What do you know about this person? Well, you have to be truthful, and you have to respond to that lawful demand for information. Rule 8.2 says you shall not knowingly or recklessly make a false statement concerning the qualifications or integrity of a judge or candidate for judicial office. First of all, my question is, what does that mean in Iowa and other states that do not have contested judicial elections? Well, I mean, it says you can't say bad things about the judge, but who is a candidate for judicial office? I don't know if there is such a thing in Iowa. But if there is such a thing, you can't say negative things about them. Here in Minnesota, where we have contested judicial elections, that's actually one where I had to watch out a little bit myself. I had to be careful because you know, I'm a concerned voter here in my county, and well, we had one judge who was he got arrested for DWI. And there are some other facts that went along with it, and after considering the facts, I was of the impression that his challenger should be elected to office. So some other attorney ran against him, and there was some other facts behind it. But I put on my website, I put on my blog, you know, because people ask me, you know, I'm an attorney, who should I vote for on these judges? And normally I just tell them, just vote for the incumbent. They're all doing a pretty good job. But in this this particular case, I thought, well, no, I think this other person who's running against this incumbent judge is more qualified. So I even put that on my website, on my blog. You know, people ask, you know, who should I vote for? I think you should vote for the person who's running against this judge. Well, I had to be very careful when I put that because I can't knowingly or recklessly make any false statements. I made sure I was very careful. In fact, I quoted the State Judicial Standards Board of their opinion as to what exactly the facts were in the case so that I wouldn't open myself up to making any false statements of fact. But also that would be true, you know, so I'm saying I said these potentially negative things about a sitting judge. So I have to be careful because I can't knowingly make a false statement or even recklessly. But that also applies to the guy who's running against him. You have to be just as careful. Just because you're speaking in favor of the incumbent and you're saying something negative about the challenger, you know, saying this guy who's running for judge, he's a crook. Well, you better not say that unless that person really is a crook. So anyway, that's after that. Incidentally, that kind of I think we have a pretty good system in Minnesota where we have contested judicial elections every now and then, and that's not the politically correct thing for attorneys to say, but because, you know, well, it should be non-political. We should just have retention elections. Well, with the retention elections, it's pretty easy for somebody just to go in and say, no, I want to vote this guy out of office. So there's actually, with our politicized system, it's actually a little bit more thought goes into voting an incumbent judge out of office, because some attorney has to step up to the plate and say, I'm willing to run against this sitting judge. And that takes a certain amount of courage on their part, because if they lose, well, probably don't want to appear before that judge again. So actually, even though it sounds political, judges, I think, are a little bit more insulated from the political process in Minnesota than they are in other states. Even though some reformers occasionally come along and say that they want to change that system, I say, I don't think that's actually going to improve things at all. But anyway, getting back on track here after my political aside there. Rule 8.3 says that if you believe that another lawyer or judge has engaged in conduct that's a violation of the rules, well, you have a duty to bring that to the attention of the appropriate authority, the Office of Lawyers, Professional Responsibility, or the Office of Judicial Standards, or whatever those offices are called in your state. Unless you got the information because it's confidential, because you're representing that person as they're an attorney, or you got the information because you were a counselor in an approved lawyer's assistance program. But other than that, you generally have a duty to turn in any dishonest attorneys or judges that you become aware of. Rule 8.4 covers miscellaneous. Can you get in disciplinary trouble for violating something that they didn't think of to write another rule about it? And the answer is yes, because if you break the rules, or if they didn't think of it when they wrote the rules, but it's dishonest, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, then you are guilty of a rule violation, even though it's not a specific rule, or any conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice, even if there's not a specific rule about it. And most states have some specific other things that they thought of. For example, most states have something that says that if you engage in any kind of discrimination or harassment or other unlawful discrimination, that's probably a violation of the rules, and probably even if it's not connected with the practice of law, although that might be either a mitigating or aggravating factor. So if you commit illegal discrimination, well, that's probably a violation of the rules, even if it was not connected with the practice of law. Some states add in something like, for example, like Nebraska does, that it's a violation of the rules to not maintain your child support that's ordered by a court. So like I say, different states might have different miscellaneous provisions put in. Finally, Rule 8.5 talks about, what about multi-state kinds of things? What state's rule applies? Generally, if you are admitted in only one state, then the state in which you are admitted is the state whose rule applies. So if you're admitted only in Iowa, Iowa law applies to whether or not there's a violation of the rules. So if there's a difference between different states' rules, that's the choice of law provision we use. We use the one for the state where you're admitted, unless your conduct had its predominant effect in another state. So yeah, I'm a Minnesota attorney, but while in Wisconsin, I commit some act that's a violation of the Wisconsin rules, it has its predominant effect in that state. Well, then the Wisconsin rule might apply to me in that scenario. If you're admitted in more than one state, then generally the default is the state where you have your primary office, and that's in determining what I was talking about right now is not so much the choice of law, but whether or not that state has authority over you. The choice of law talks about mostly, predominantly your the state where you. Where you have your primary practice. That's kind of the default state. Unless the conduct has its predominant effect in another state, then that state's rules apply. These don't come up very often. One interesting case where it did come up was I had a Michigan attorney taking this program, and I forget whether she was admitted in also in Minnesota or maybe it was Wisconsin, she was admitted in both Michigan and, let's say, Minnesota. Her question was, well, can she get referral fees? Because apparently in Michigan, referral fees are okay. They can get referral fees, because they're not permitted in Minnesota. My understanding is they are permitted in California. So her question was, well, here I'm in my Michigan office. I have a Michigan case that I referred to another attorney in Michigan, and when the case is over, I'm going to get a check for a referral fee, and that's permitted under Michigan law. Well, will I get in trouble for violating the Minnesota law? So that's where that kind of question comes up, and in that case, we decided that she doesn't have anything to worry about because she's admitted in more than one state, but the jurisdiction where her principal practice or where her principal place of business is applies. So it was a Michigan case with a Michigan client referred to another Michigan attorney. It's okay, even though that Minnesota would not permit that. However, the rule points out that if the conduct has its predominant effect in another jurisdiction, then that other jurisdiction's rules would apply. So, for example, if she had a Minnesota client who was injured in an accident and she referred him to another attorney, well, then she would probably be violating the Minnesota referral fee rule. So anyway, that's where our overview of the rules kind of wraps up. And in our remaining, I guess we only have about 40 minutes, even though I promised an hour of it. Well, we kind of covered some of the conflicts of interest rules in the main part of the program. But in the main remainder of the program, we will turn to the other set of course materials that came with the program, entitled Conflicts of Interest 2019, because when we went over the Rule 1.7 in our general overview of the program, that doesn't really say very much there. It doesn't give you very much practical guidance, because all Rule 1.7 has to say is you shall not represent a client if there's a conflict of interest. Well, you already knew that. And it gives a definition of conflict of interest in such vague terms that, what exactly does this mean? Obviously representing one client directly adverse to another client. You already knew that was a conflict of interest. But the general rule is that you can't represent the new client if there's a significant risk that the representation of some client will be materially limited. Well, what does that mean? That could mean anything. So that's why I like to spend maybe about an hour trying to flesh out what that means exactly. So in the remainder of the program, that's what we'll try to do. But as you'll see, well, even with a full hour or even a couple hours, we'll really just scratch the surface on what that means your representation of some client will be materially limited. What does that mean? Before we get into that, let's talk about some specific rules. If there is kind of a minor conflict of interest, kind of a theoretical conflict of interest, well, that can be waived by the clients. So conflicts of interest can be consented to unless they're really bad. Because if it's a real conflict of interest and you do not in good faith believe that you can provide competent and diligent representation to both of the clients, well, in that case, no matter how much they consent, it's just not going to be permitted. especially, you know, if it's something really severe, like, you know, one client representing a case against another client or whatever. You know, if it's a bad conflict of interest, then it cannot be waived. So, yeah, conflicts of interest can be consented to, but they have to be they can't be cases where you know, if it can't be a real conflict of interest. If you believe that you can't competently and diligently represent both of these people, well, then you have to bow out. And we'll talk a little bit later about what it means to bow out. Now, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, can you represent both spouses in a divorce? Well, the answer is it's a really bad idea. And you probably shouldn't do that. But there might be some rare cases where you'd be able to do that. But not in Iowa. If you're an Iowa attorney, it says in no event shall you represent both parties in a dissolution of marriage case. So like I say, that's probably a really bad idea to do it in any state. Because no matter how amicable these two spouses are, no matter how much they've resolved their disputes, well, the fact still remains is they've decided they can't live with each other anymore. So there's at least a potential conflict of interest arising when one of them comes on later and says, "Well, wait a minute, I thought I was going to get the silverware." Well, I never said that. Well, you should have told me that because, you know, you owed me a duty. Well, you know, it was a conflict of interest. So you probably don't want to do that. But Iowa has kind of a blanket prohibition. And the only practical difference I can see that that would make for Iowa attorneys is that for me as a Minnesota attorney, because I don't have an absolute prohibition, well, it seems to me there might be some situations where I would give informal advice to people facing divorce. Well, both of the spouses might come to me and seeking some informal guidance, and they might not even pay me for it. It might just be, you know, they're asking for some friendly advice. You know, so we have decided to get a divorce, and we have decided to get a divorce, and we have decided to file this pro se petition that we got off the court website. But we don't understand what it means, and you know, on this party, we need help filling out the form or whatever. Can I give them help? Well, probably. I'm not formally representing them, you know, so they come to me with this paper and say, "We just don't understand how to fill out this form. Can you help us?" I could probably do that. That's probably okay for me as a Minnesota attorney. But on the other hand, the Iowa attorney faced with that same situation, you know, it says under no circumstance, in no event shall you represent both parties. So the Iowa attorney, and maybe I should even say this as a Minnesota attorney, maybe I should say, "No, I'm sorry, I can't talk to both of you. I can talk to one of you, and you know, give unbiased advice to that one person, but I can't do that for both of you." Well, the Iowa attorney definitely has to say that in that situation. So I would watch out as an Iowa attorney, even in those informal situations where you're called upon to give advice, that you might need to be a little bit more careful even than I am as a Minnesota attorney, because Iowa adds that in no event shall you represent both spouses. But anyway, that's all that Rule 1.7 really has to say. It just kind of says, yeah, conflicts of interest are a bad idea, and you don't want to engage in them. So like I say, in our remaining 35 minutes or so, I want to flesh that out just a little bit to get you thinking about what these conflict of interest situations, because we're still just going to scratch the surface. We're not going to get into a lot of detail. But probably what is the most common situation? Well, if you only have one client, you know, if you are corporate in-house counsel for a corporation, well, you only have one client. You never have to worry about conflicts of interest, or well, not so much. Some things you do have to worry about, but in general, you know, if you only have one client, yeah, you don't have to worry too much about it. But if anytime you have more than one client, there's always that potential that, you know, client A is going to have some position that's kind of adverse to client B. And probably the most common situation would be a joint representation. You're representing both of the plaintiffs, or you're representing both of the defendants. Anytime you're representing both plaintiffs or both defendants, or you know, anytime you're representing more than one person, you always have to be mindful of the potential for a conflict of interest. First, we're going to talk about some kind of common joint representation situations. I guess we already talked about this first material here on the representing both spouses. But one example would be driver and passenger. So can you represent, you have two plaintiffs hobble into your office who were injured in a car accident. One of them was the driver and one of them was the passenger, and their car got crashed into by the gross negligence of some defendant who was just careening down the road drunk. Both of your clients were doing everything just right, perfectly, and then this drunk driver comes in and crashes into them and injures both of them. Can you represent both of those plaintiffs? Well, the answer is sure. Why not? Obviously, you can, because they both have exactly the same claim against that other driver. So it's probably okay, but maybe it's not okay, because what you have to be aware of is that there's always the potential that your driver client will, that your passenger client will have a claim against the driver client. And then if that happens to take place, well, then you have a pretty big conflict of interest, because now suddenly your clients are not similarly situated. They both don't just have a complaint against this third party. One of your clients has a claim against your other client. Now, the substantive law might say that claim doesn't exist because, you know, it might be a family member, so you know there might be spousal immunity or something like that. But in general, you have to keep that in the back of your mind that one of your plaintiffs potentially has a claim against the other client. And we cite a couple of cases here talking about that. And it's pretty well settled in most states, so I had to dig kind of deep to find some cases talking about that. But I have one case, for example, from Puerto Rico and one from the District of Columbia addressing that, the situation of driver and passenger. So always be mindful of that anytime you're representing both of the plaintiffs who were injured, that and especially in the context of driver-passenger, there's a very real possibility that one of them is going to have a claim against the other one. It wasn't just 100% that other guy's fault. There was some fault on the part of your driver. It's kind of hard for a passenger to be at fault for an accident. So it's unlikely that there'll be a claim against the passenger, but there very likely could be a claim against the driver. So you have to watch out for that. One special case of joint representation is in the criminal context. And it's kind of an interesting topic to cover. If you don't practice in the area of criminal law, you probably don't have to worry about this. If you do practice regularly in the area of criminal law, well, you're probably aware of these rules already. But it's kind of an interesting situation if you don't practice in criminal law all the time. It's a pitfall that you have to watch out for. Can you represent both defendants who were charged with a crime? So your two people, your two clients get arrested because they were holding up the 7-Eleven or whatever, or allegedly, and you're going to defend them. Well, you have to ask yourself the question, always in conflict of interest, or any time you have more than one client, you have to say to yourself, are my client's interests exactly the same? And if their interests are exactly the same, then you don't have to worry about it. There's no conflict of interest. But if there's a possibility that their interests diverge, if one of them possibly has some advantage in going against the other one, well, then there's a potential conflict of interest. And there's always a very real possibility of conflict of interest in a criminal case, as best exemplified by the Coleman case, which is a Minnesota case from 2011. And this is kind of Attorney Coleman should have realized that there was a problem here, because as you will notice, most of these cases we're citing are criminal cases Somebody's appealing, saying, well, there was a conflict of interest. Well, if you look at the caption of this case, it says, INRI disciplinary action against Coleman. So here, Attorney Coleman got himself into disciplinary trouble for taking this criminal case despite this conflict of interest. So the Minnesota Supreme Court said, we're going to impose discipline on you because you should have known better than to take this, than to represent both of these defendants in this criminal case. Because what happened here was Attorney Coleman was representing two defendants who were charged with, they had something illegal in their car. I think it was an illegal weapon. It was a gun that was found in their car. But it was some kind of illegal, some contraband item that was found inside the car with the two defendants. So the police pulled over this car. There was one guy driving. There was one passenger. And for whatever reason, they did a search of the car, and lo and behold, they found a gun. And where was the gun? Well, the gun was in the center console of the car. So right between, equidistant between the driver and the passenger, there was this gun. In this console. So the driver was sitting there with his right elbow sitting on the console, and the passenger was sitting there with his left elbow sitting on the console, and right underneath their respective elbows was a gun. And they were charged with possession of this gun, and Attorney Coleman was representing both of them. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court in this case said, Coleman, you should have seen that there was going to be a potential problem there, because what is the defense going to be? What's the driver's defense going to be? The driver's defense is going to be, I had no idea that there was a gun there. I just saw my friend over there, and I gave him a ride, and he put that gun in the center console. I'd never seen that gun before in my life. It belongs to him. It's his fault. He's the one who's guilty. After all, he was right there underneath his left elbow. Well, okay, so that's what the driver's defense is going to be. What's the passenger's defense going to be? The passenger's defense is going to be, I had no idea that there was a gun in the car. I was just minding my own business. My friend came along and said he would give me a ride, so I got in the car. I had no idea that there was a gun in there. I'd never seen that gun before in my life. It was his gun. After all, it was right in his car, right underneath his right elbow. The Minnesota Supreme Court said you should have seen that coming, that they were going to both be pointing the finger at each other, trying to get out of it. And then that's obviously a conflict of interest, because as long as you have, defendant two is trying to get off by saying it's all defendant one's fault, that's a readily apparent conflict of interest. And you should have seen that to the point of, we are going to discipline you as an attorney for taking on that case, if that conflict of interest. Now, on the other hand, though, there might be a lot more subtle conflicts of interest because there might be cases where, the two defendants are going to, they're going to hang together. Hang together or will hang separately or whatever. Because it's exactly the same case against both of them. So these two guys come in to rob the 7-Eleven, and they're both pointing a gun at the clerk, and they both, simultaneously utter saying, this is a robbery, give us the money. Either they're both guilty or they're both innocent. Maybe it was just a big misunderstanding or whatever, and it wasn't really a robbery. But either they're both guilty or they're both innocent. Well, even in that situation, there's a potential conflict of interest because there's always the possibility that the attorney will get a phone call saying, I tell you what, I don't have enough evidence to convict both of these defendants, but I will give you, you'll get probation If you testify against your friend and tell about what the crime is. I realize that both of you are equally guilty, but I need to get one of you to testify against the other one. Whichever one of you comes and testifies first, you're going to get a lucky break. If you're representing both defendants, what do you do in that situation? Because if you get that phone call and you're the attorney for just one of the defendants, You tell your client, you know, get down there and confess right away because you're going to get off with probation, and you want to get down there before your co-defendant gets there. But you can't give that advice if you're representing both of them. So that's why there's kind of a presumptive conflict of interest in any criminal case. Now, the skeptic would say, well, that's kind of a pro-prosecution rule. Because if those two defendants are separately represented and they get that phone call, well then the first one who gets the phone call is the one who's gonna cave. Whereas in that same situation, if one attorney is representing both of them, they're putting up a united front and saying, I'm sorry, neither of my clients is going to testify against the other one. So I guess you just don't have a case, you know. So it's kind of a pro-prosecution rule, really. But on the other hand, it's framed in terms of being for your own protection, defendant. And there's a constitutional dimension to that, too, is these two cases I said here, I guess Holloway and Kyler, make clear that the Constitution says that you have the right to assistance of counsel, and somehow the Supreme Court has interpreted that to mean that you have the right to an effective assistance of counsel, and effective means that you have an attorney who does not have a conflict of interest. So therefore, there's a constitutional dimension to this. And the courts have to be proactive in enforcing that constitutional right. And an example of how they've proactively done that is by the adoption of Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 17.03. Now, even those of you who are not in Minnesota, Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure is really just a codification of those two Supreme Court cases. So very similar procedures will apply in any other state, even if they don't have a rule of criminal procedure specifying it. So under Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 17, or under just general principles in other states, here's what the court's duty is. The trial judge has a specific duty anytime two or more defendants come into court represented by the same attorney. The court must do the following. The court must address each defendant personally on the record. So, hello, defendant number one. Hello, defendant number two. The court has to advise each defendant of the potential danger of dual representation. Defendants, I see you both have the same attorney. There is a potential danger here because what if that phone call comes from the prosecutor? What's your attorney going to do about it? One of you might miss out on a chance to get off. The court has to give each defendant an opportunity to question the court. So do you have any questions? So that's easy enough. The court can do that. But what as a practical matter makes it impossible for two defendants to have the same attorney is the following requirement, because the court must elicit from each defendant in a narrative statement that the defendant has to. So in other words, the defendant has to say the following four things. In their own words, without leading questions, the defendant has to be able to say, Your Honor, thank you for giving me that information. I have been advised on the right to effective representation. Your Honor, I understand the details of my attorney's potential conflict of interest and the potential perils for such a conflict. Your Honor, I have discussed the matter with my attorney, and if I wanted to, I know I had the right to discuss it with outside attorney. And in light of all the following, Your Honor, I hereby voluntarily waive my constitutional right to separate counsel. Those words have to come out of the defendant's mouth, and like I say, without leading questions. They have to actually say those things. Well, most criminal defendants probably you're not going to be able to get them to utter those words too much. So as a practical matter, one attorney cannot represent two criminal defendants. Although in theory it might be possible. So perhaps in the case of a sophisticated defendant of some kind. But your typical criminal defendant, probably not. They probably both need to lawyer up separately. Okay, now if you work in the insurance defense context, you will understand that you're if you're working for you're getting paid by the insurance company, but your client is the insured. You know, your client is the driver who's accused of the accident or whatever. You understand all of that. The one thing that you might not be aware of that I just want to point out to you is, well, in Minnesota, it's okay for you to represent the insurance company in some unrelated thing. So, yeah, the insurance company hired you to defend this person. They're insured, but you're also, handling the uninsured motorist claim or something. And in that, your client is the insurance company. And that's acceptable in Minnesota, except perhaps in some rare situations. But in Arkansas, Connecticut, and Montana, and possibly some other states, it's not permitted. So if you are an insurance defense attorney and you ever happen to have a case in Arkansas, Connecticut, or Montana, well, then you want to carefully read the cases that are cited in this Pine Island case. Because it cites cases from Arkansas, Connecticut, and Montana saying you can't do that. You can't represent the insurance company as their attorney in another case as long as you're representing their insured in this one. That's not the law in Minnesota, and I think if you're in the insurance defense biz, you probably already know that. But if you like I say, just be aware of that. If you ever come into across a case in Arkansas, Connecticut, or Montana, or possibly other states, there might be a more restrictive rule. Can you represent a the corporation and the people within the corporation? So as we mentioned before, I think it was Rule 1.16 or something, or no, 1.13, when we were talking about you as the attorney for a corporation. Well, normally, if you're the attorney for the corporation, you're the attorney for the corporation, and you don't have any other duties to other people. But can you assume those duties? Can you be the attorney for the corporation and for the company president, or for the the trucking company and the truck driver? Well, you certainly can. But when you do, keep in mind that that's a case of joint representation. So there's always a potential for conflict of interest. What about disputes between shareholders? That gets it a little bit more complicated because in this Bottoms versus Stapleton case, an Iowa case from 2005, it was a case of a minority shareholder suing the majority shareholder. So it was, you have the 49% shareholder and the 51% shareholder. Well, how do you settle disputes between the 49% shareholder and the 51% shareholder? Well, the 49% shareholder has to allege that the 51% shareholder is not acting in the best interest of the corporation. So their complaint will say things like, I am suing on behalf of the corporation. So the plaintiff claims to be representing the corporation. You're representing the 51% guy who's saying, no, my guy represents the corporation. Well, the corporation is one of the named parties in the lawsuit because even though the plaintiff claims that I am representing the interests of the corporation is still the defendant. So it's kind of like the corporation is on both sides of the litigation. So can you, as the attorney for the defendant, put in an answer on behalf of the corporation? And the Bottoms case says yes, because even though theoretically you're representing this party that's on both sides, that's both a plaintiff and a defendant, that's just kind of a theoretical construct because we recognize that you're really representing the 51% shareholder. So, in other words, the corporation doesn't have to go out and hire a separate lawyer just to represent the name. You can still represent both. And that's the holding of the Bottoms case. But on the other hand, the Rowan case, an earlier case from the same court, says, but on the other hand, if there's some like an actual accusation of wrongdoing, so it's not just a question of business judgment, but the 49% shareholder is accusing the 51% shareholder of embezzlement or something, well, then it might be a different case, because then clearly the embezzler, if those allegations are true, then that person clearly is acting contrary to the interests of the corporation. So I think we can say that where you draw the line in those cases is it a business judgment kind of thing? And if the lawsuit is about a business judgment kind of issue, then the Bottoms case says yes, one attorney can represent both defendants. On the other hand, the Rowan case says that if it's more of a misconduct kind of thing, then no, you can't represent both, and the corporation and the 51% owner would both need separate attorneys. Business transactions between clients is our next topic, and it's kind of an interesting, weird case that I picked to talk about that. Anytime you have two clients and they are both engaged in a business transaction between themselves, well, there's a potential for a conflict of interest. And I think we would see that, and that probably weren't too many cases on point because it's usually pretty obvious. The case was kind of interesting. This poor attorney named Wright, somewhere in Iowa, he had a broad practice of law. He represented a lot of different people. He did personal injury cases. He did criminal cases. One day one of his criminal defendants came in and said, I just got this email from Nigeria. And it turns out my long lost cousin in Nigeria just died, and I'm going to be getting $18.8 million from my long lost cousin in Nigeria. So the attorney said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear about your cousin passing away. I'm sure you're in a lot of grief." And well, I actually never met the guy. I didn't realize I had a long lost cousin in Nigeria, but I'm going to get $18.8 million. Only one slight problem. I have to come up with $177,000 to cover the taxes. I don't have $177,000. Well, Attorney Wright thought about it for a minute and said, "You know what? I don't have $177,000 either, but I just settled a personal injury case for another client. And I know he has $177,000 coming. It'll be kind of a win-win situation for everybody. You'll get your $18.8 million. The reason why you went to a life of crime is because of your poverty. Well, now you don't have to worry about that anymore. The $18.8 million will bring you up out of poverty. This other guy, I'm sure you'll give a fair interest rate for the borrowing this money for a short period of time, so he'll do okay. So it'll be a win-win situation for everybody." He got the two clients together. Well, it turns out, who would have ever seen this coming, but the guy didn't really have a long-lost cousin in Nigeria. It was actually just a scam. And they took the $177,000 down to the Western Union office, and they never saw it again. Understandably, the personal injury client was kind of upset about this, and he brought a complaint at the Iowa Disciplinary Board. The Supreme Court examined it as if it was a business transaction between clients. What really happened here, they didn't really address the incompetence matter too much, but they said, "You know what? This is really a conflict of interest. You should have warned your personal injury client a little bit more that this was kind of a risky proposition, and you didn't do that because you had stars in your eyes because you thought you were helping this other client get the $18.8 million. So it was really a conflict of interest of a business transaction between clients going bad. Although they pointed out that you probably should have known better too. So watch out when you get those emails from Nigeria. On the other hand, I've actually gotten real clients, not too often, but occasionally I get real clients from emails that I get from foreign countries. But you have to watch out for them really carefully. And what the scam typically is, And is they will, you know, want to retain you, and they'll send you a cashier's check for a nice, comfortable retainer. But then I think the scam is they try to get you to advance some funds out of that to pay some ostensible bill or something. So watch out for those. But on the other hand, who I really feel sorry for is the honest businessmen in Nigeria who. If they need a lawyer in America, they're going to have a hard time finding one. So they're the real victims of those kinds of scams, I think. In our remaining 5 minutes here, we'll just kind of polish up closely related entities. Yeah, if you represent the Acme Widget Company, you probably can't take cases against, Acme Widgets of Canada Limited, because they're a closely related company, even though it's not, strictly speaking, exactly the same client. Be careful if you ever represent an adverse party in an unrelated matter. This case from Tennessee, incidentally, I'm just going to pause ever so briefly here while I just need to refresh something on my on the conference call system here. This attorney in Tennessee, he was retained for purposes of a divorce case, and he collected some money from the wife to represent her in the divorce. The case kind of got put on hold for a while, eventually the ex or the husband came in and said, I understand you, my wife retained you for a divorce, so let's try to work this out. Turns out the husband had a workers' comp case, and lo and behold, this Tennessee attorney also did workers' comp. So they took the workers' comp case, and the divorce case kind of got put on hold. And the wife complained about that and said, "No, you have to be careful. Even though it's an unrelated case, you can't take on the ex-husband's case. You have to zealously prosecute the thing that you were hired for first. So watch out for that." Also kind of on the representing the opposing party in an unrelated matter. We have this attorney who was a part-time city attorney, and he also represented the driver trying to get back his driver's license. But one of the things that the driver lost the driver's license for in the first place was a case that this very prosecutor had prosecuted. So a guy got a speeding ticket, prosecuted by the attorney, and then 5 years later, the guy comes in and says, "Hey, can I hire you to get my driver's license back?" And the Iowa Supreme Court said that even though technically speaking it's a different party, because the first time you were representing the city and this time you were representing the State Department of Motor Vehicles, you still can't do that. It's not really an unrelated case. So you have to watch out for that. If you ever represent the buyer and the seller, you have to be extremely careful. If you can look at this Wagner case here from Iowa, if you have a couple of sophisticated real estate clients, who want you to, draft the deed for the deal that's already been, they've worked out all the details, that's probably okay. But on the other hand, there are always so many terms open for the sale of a business or sale of a property, you really can't represent both the buyer and the seller. You have to watch out for that. One interesting case is turning to the subject of former clients. Oh, we already told you that former clients, you have to worry about confidentiality mostly. One interesting case came up in the Wisconsin case of Jesse v. Danforth in deciding whether somebody is a former client. It was an attorney somewhere in Wisconsin, I think kind of a medium-sized city. All the doctors in that town wanted to, they needed an MRI machine or something in town. And well, MRI machines are pretty expensive, so one physician can't afford it, but all 23 of them in town can. So the 23 doctors in town came into his office, and they probably packed into the conference room or whatever, and said, "Yeah, we need to buy an MRI machine. So we want you to incorporate the firm that will own the MRI machine, and we're going to have 23 stockholders, and then we'll hire somebody to run the MRI machine. We don't have to, send people to Madison or Rochester anymore. We can do the MRIs right here in town." So the attorney prepared the articles of incorporation and sent them to the Secretary of State, and got the deluxe leather binder with all the corporate materials, and issued the stock certificates and everything. Well, then a couple of years later, one of these doctors in town was getting sued for malpractice, and this attorney was suing one of the 23 doctors in town. And the doctor said, "Well, wait a minute, you can't sue me. I'm your former client." But the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, "No, you are not a former client, because the former client was the corporation, and you were just one of the stockholders for it, even though you had a check here that had your name on it, said attorney's fees." But it's a pretty narrow rule. It's only for formation of a corporation, and the corporation has to be ultimately formed. Estate planning. Can you represent somebody who wrote the will and the party who got cut off from the will? And the answer is yes, under this ABA formal opinion. You can look at that. What happens if you do have a conflict of interest, if you discover later on there's a conflict of interest? The Picker case expresses the hot potato doctrine. And the hot potato doctrine says that you may not drop a client like a hot potato, especially if it's in order to keep a far more lucrative client. So in other words, the default position is if you discover a conflict of interest, you probably have to drop both of the clients. But on the other hand, the same court in the Gould case a few years later said, well, but there might be exceptions to that. We'll look at the equities of the situation. So if you were not at fault or anything. Yes, parties can consent to dual representation. We talk about that a little bit here. An interesting thing, can an attorney be a member of a labor union? Mostly we're talking about public employee unions. So in this California case, the county attorneys formed a union, and can they do that? Well, the argument is, well, no, you can't do that because you're supposed to be on the same side of the table as your client. And here, by definition, if you're in a labor union, you're on the other side of the bargaining table from your client, and we can't have that. But the California Supreme Court said that was okay. I had one Minnesota attorney who said that she was a member of a labor union as a state employee, and the state Board of Professional Responsibility said that that was okay. So anyway, let me give one last code number here, and that'll be H12. H as in hotel 12. H12 is our final code number. So at this point, those of you listening on the podcast, thank you very much for attending. Please email me those code numbers for the section of the program that you heard, to clem.law@usa.net. And based upon that, I will give you your certificate of attendance. And if you have any substantive questions about the program, feel free to email those to me as well, or give me a call. Again, clem.law@usa.net, or you can give me a call at 612-378-7751 if you have any questions. And I promise to answer those in the period required by your state Supreme Court, which is usually about 24 hours or more likely instantaneously. So for those of you taking the podcast, thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you at future programs.